Hi everyone, and welcome to Take 10 for Torah number 441. Any questions, comments, suggestions, recommendations, or sponsorships, please let me know at Rabbi Yismach at take10fortorah.org. This week is Parshas Mishpatim. Now, Parshas Mishpatim gets very legalistic. It gets into very nitty-gritty laws, and it begins, Ve'ela HaMishpatim, and these are the laws. Rashi points out, Ve'ela seems to connect it, using that letter Vav as a conjunctive to the Parsha beforehand, Parshas Yisro, so as if to say that it's connected in that Ma Rishonu Misinai Af Elu Misinai. The same way the material in last week's parasha, the moments of revelation, that story, and the Ten Commandments exist and came from Sinai, so too all of the laws herein. Now Rav Hirsch, he begins Parshas Mishpatim with the following. He says, to the unprejudiced mind, again, this is Rav Hirsch, Mishpatim 11.1, Shmos 11.1, to the unprejudiced mind, nothing can show so strikingly the truth of the traditional oral law as the first two paragraphs with which this Mosaic law-giving starts. The civil and criminal laws of the nation are to be given. The fundamental basis and the ordinances of justice and humaneness are to be laid down, which are to govern the relationship and behavior of man to his fellow man. The first matter to be dealt with, quite naturally, is the rights of man. But incredibly, it starts with the sentences when a man sells another man, and when a man sells his daughter. How unthinkable if actually this written word, the book of the law of the Jewish nation, should really be the one and only source of the Jewish conception of rights. What a mass of laws and jurisprudence must have already been said and fixed, considered, laid down, and explained before the book of law could reach these laws, or even speak of them, which, after all, are only quite exceptional cases. Now, the point that he's making is, and it's a part of a longer essay, and he says some significant things in this essay, but the point that he's making is very simply, it's impossible to imagine that what comes immediately after the revelation are the laws of when you buy a slave, when you buy a servant. There must be a background, there must be some basic laws about rights to discuss the far applications in the very specific scenarios, which are, as he says, quite exceptional and very irregular. And this really lends to the idea of the oral Torah in addition to a written Torah. We know that the Torah is given. We have the five books of Moses. We have all of the material that exists in the scrolls, in the Torahs that we have. But we also know that we believe that there is more information than just what we have in the written Torah. The Rav Hirsch understands these as sort of written notes on an oral lecture. That's the purpose of the written Torah, but that's a perspective hopefully we'll get to at a different time. The discussion about this, of course, is very far-reaching and very significant. Is all the material, all of the information that we need to know to live the Jewish life found in the five books of Moses, found in the written version of our Torah? So we know the very well-known story, Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Lamed Aleph, Amid Aleph. It says, Tanu Rabbanan Masa Benachri Echad Shebo Lefnei Shammai. There was once a Gentile who comes before Shammai and says, Kama Toros Yesh Lechem, how many Toros do you have? Meaning, how many bodies of law are there? Amar Lo, Shammai responds, Shtayim, there are two. There's Torah Shebichsav, Torah Shebal Peh. There's one of each. Amar Lo, Shebichsav Amim Amincha, Ushebal Peh Einim Amincha. I believe you about the written Torah. It's sitting right in front of me. I can look at your scroll. I see it. But the oral Torah, you know, it's more ephemeral. I don't really know what you're talking about. I don't believe you. Girani, convert me. Amanash Tlamdani, Torah Shebichsav. Convert me so that you will teach me only Torah Shebichsav. Meaning, I only want to be a Jew inasmuch that I can accept the written Torah, not the oral Torah. Garbo, Shammai was very frustrated with him. He, you know, I don't know, yelled at him. Vehotzio ben Azifa, and he didn't treat him very nicely. Balofnei Hillel, this same Gentile with that same problem, comes before Hillel. He says, Gaira. And so the Gemara tells us that Hillel indeed converted him. And then the games start. Yomakama Armale Aleph Beis Gimel Dalad. So the first day, Hillel's giving him his education, his Jewish education. He says, Aleph Beis Gimel Dalad, this is the Jewish alphabet. Lemachar, the next day, Apichle. He told it the other way around. So he switched the Aleph Beis Gimel Dalad to Dalad Gimel Beis Aleph. Amarle, says the Gentile, Vaha Esmal Lo Amartile Lo Hachi. But Esmal, yesterday, you said the other way around. It was Aleph through Dalad, not the other way around. Amar Lo, responds Hillel, Yes, you relied on me in regard to this. You should rely on me in regard to Torah Shebaal Peh as well. And what he's saying is something more than just, hey, you trusted me on this, trust me that this Torah Shebaal Peh. He's saying the very nature of the alphabet, the fact that these letters go in sequence, the fact that when you read the book, you're supposed to read from the top down and not the other way around. The fact that the words form the way they do really involve an oral tradition of some kind. To what extent the oral tradition goes, that's a separate question, but it's very difficult to remove the notion of oral tradition from a written text. Even the sects that have existed throughout Jewish history that did not believe in the rabbinic version of the oral tradition believed in an oral tradition. That there is something, a body of information that you need to know just to be able to get through the written information is obvious and very simple. So what there's a tremendous amount to talk about here in regard to how do we know? How can you look at the Torah and know that there's an oral tradition? So I'll just mention some very simple ideas, very simple places where this comes up. One of them, of course, is the Rav Hirsch I began with. Rav Hirsch says that you can't read Mishpatim and assume that this is all we got. The type of niche cases that come up and the few and far between experiences that are actually painting real life is very odd for this to be the basis of our law. There has to be a corpus of information that's assumed already. We have this idea again and again, references in the Torah or a need for there to be an oral tradition. For example, you know, just simple narrative issues. You have contradictions. How long were the Jews in Egypt? Were they there 430 years? Were they there 350, which is what you result in if you do the math? How many Jews went down to Egypt? Do you have a report of 70? Do you have a report of 69? Some census reports are not as they come out if you do the counting. You have different names of God. You have different things which require explanation. You have different differences in instructions. You have the mitzvah of matzah. One mitzvah of matzah says you eat it for 7 days. One says you eat it for 6 days. You have the prohibition of chametz, where it says 7 days leaven may not be found in your homes. Another one says on the first day you can't rid yourselves of chametz. How in the world do we jive all of these ideas? We have sometimes contradictory actions where there's a Torah law and then we see somebody behaving in a way which seems against that Torah law. How do we understand that? What do we do when we have contradictory principles? We have circumcision, we have Shabbat. Like, those two things, can they go in concert? Are they objectionable? Can they go on at the same time or not? And so there's a variety of things that require that type of explanation that when reading the physical, the written text, you have no choice but to conclude that there's something more. Other examples include certain commandments where there's a reference to a body of law that is that must exist somewhere but is not in this book. So for example, when it talks about Shechita, it says that you're going to go to the land of Israel and you're going to be very distant from that place where God created the Beis HaMikdash, and you're going to go and slaughter your cattle and your sheep, because you're going to want to eat. So how are you going to slaughter it? So the pasuk says, "Kasher tzivi sicha, as I have commanded you," and you're going to eat it wherever you are. You don't need to be near a Beis HaMikdash to eat. You could slaughter animals wherever you want, because you know that's how we make meat. And so this notion of slaughtering, how do we know that it exists? It exists because the Torah says, and it refers to the fact that it exists. But where do these laws exist? I'm not sure, because the pasuk just says, "Kasher tzivi sicha, as I have commanded you," without actually telling us where that is. Now, and a lot of this tradition, the Gemara even discusses how it's halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, which we'll talk about a different time, is a body of laws which really are just passed down from generation to generation, and that's how we know that these things exist. But there are many other examples as well. You know, you read the Torah says, "Pru uruvu," you know, go and be fruitful and multiply. So, like, what exactly is that talking about? What does that mean? Is it a commandment? Is it a blessing? Who's God talking to? Is he talking to the man? Is he talking to the woman? Puravu, fruitful, multiply. Like, what type of fruit? Or how many types of kids? How many kids? What's called kids? You know, do they have to go to a certain age for me to fulfill the mitzvah? Do grandchildren count? Do they count? What exactly does it mean? Of course, more famously, we have the prohibition of Shabbos. When it comes to Shabbos, the Torah refers a few times to Shabbos and not doing work, but work in no place is defined, and again, altogether, there are a bunch of areas in the Torah that seem to indicate that there is something else happening, there's something else there, which is going to answer these questions and describe where these laws are derived. That's what we call the Oral Torah. And in future classes, I'd like to talk about more of these examples, why there's an Oral Torah, and why it's so important that there is one. Have a great day. Bye-bye.